You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming. Do you wake up on the throne? I wonder where you are and live with all your faults. I want to wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all. So why don't you smile?
Minutes after 9 o'clock on the Monday, we continue. Joining me through the wonders of Skype is Alex Hollings. Alex, what's up?
How's it going, brother? Good to be here.
All right, man. You know what? I saw one of my interviews that he posted on Facebook, made a motivated comment on it. Because the dude it was about is a Beirut Marine named Matt Gospodinovich. You know, we had to shorten that thing to Gospo. One of those big Southern dudes that you meet in the Marine Corps, right?
Bigger, there always are, absolutely.
Right? Big, funny as hell, right? That slow talking, right? Way from Mississippi. And, a mutual friend said, "Hey, Mac, I don't know if you saw, but he was killed." And I was like, no. So, yeah. Gospo, man. He was a big dude. And, you know, he was a Lance Corporal on October 23rd, 1983, when the building detonated in Beirut, when it was exploded. And he talks about he was in 10th Marines. He's one, I can't remember which battery, but they were getting ready to swap guys out at some place. And all of a sudden the ground shook. And he tells this incredible story of, of that day and then struggling, afterwards. Coming home and, I mean, you know, going to that pile. And, and again, as a Lance Corporal, so he's what, 20 years old or something like that, 2019, something like that.
Yeah, he could even be a late 18,
know? Right, depending on when he joined. So it's just sad day yesterday. I was bummed out all day, so anyway.
Absolutely, with good reason. Well, rest easy, brother.
Yeah, until we see him again, right, on the other side. All right, so now update us. Like, your career changes faster than most teenagers change clothes. So where are we right now? Give us
not necessarily by design, you know. The nature of digital media is that...
You know what, that is the truth.
The digital media is constantly changing. You know, I went to grad school from 2015 to 2017, and so not that long ago, right? I graduated just a couple of years ago, and when I, you know, my master's is in communications, and I had a big emphasis on digital media, and I would argue that even a lot of the case studies that we were studying in an online... I did the first portion of my syllabus in person, and then I switched to online. But in an online syllabus about digital marketing, I'd argue that most of the case studies we studied in school don't hold true anymore. You know, that's how fast, you know, this entire industry is changing. But that's subject to a different discussion. Today, I'm still working over at the Loadout Room. I'm still running content on the Loadout Room, but my company is actually moving forward with an all-new website that's going to be encompassing all kinds of new stuff. So operations on the Loadout Room have slowed down a bit while we're doing all this background stuff on this new website we're launching. But my work is still found there every day on thenewsrep.com. You know, you can also still find my stuff on We Are the Mighty a lot. You can find my stuff on Business Insider, Military.com, Yahoo News, Popular Mechanics. I try my best to make it real easy to find me to yell at, you know, so... You can find me all over the place, but you can find most of my work, especially my foreign policy and defense technology work, on thenewsrep.com for now. It'll probably be changing here next month to an all-new website with a new structure
that,
will involve all the stuff from News Rep, all the stuff from the loadout room, a lot of my work from Fighter Sweep, as well as content from specialoperations.com. So it's going to be a real big change. Yeah. I'm excited about it. I think it'll be cool. What, the real benefit here is honestly giving our marketing team a break. You know, they've been, our poor marketing team is responsible for trying to manage social media and all kinds of stuff for four different websites. Now they're going to be able to focus on one website that's got all of our content. So, you know, I think that'll be a really good change. I'm looking forward to how it's going to, you know, obviously anytime there's a change, there's a lot of anxiety, there's a lot of fear. I wonder what all this stuff we're doing in the background, how it'll manifest. But I really hope the readers dig it.
I just want people to know that if you ever want to get into a dynamic field, digital media is certainly not.
Now, when you say a dynamic field, do you mean like it's a very exciting time to be in digital media? Because like this week you may be wealthy and next week you may be a waiter.
It can.
Yeah, it's a dynamic field.
It can be, right?
You know, but that's kind of what's so exciting about this industry. You know, I complain a lot about how difficult it can be to stay on top of the game when it comes to digital media, especially right now.
Well, let me tell you things that I roll my eyes over, right?
I'm all ears.
Right? Let's set up a website, and then we can, you know, we can do social media for it, you know? And for people that don't know, when you say that, I mean, social media is hours every day.
It absolutely is. And a lot of people don't realize that. Well, because we all use social media. So to a certain extent, we see it as like driving a car, right? Like, it can't be hard. I do it every day. But the truth of the matter is that managing social media for an outlet is a very different entity than managing social media for yourself, even for your own brand, you know? People talk about how much they hate clickbait and bias. Clickbait and bias are created through social media engagement. You know, the reason why clickbait is so pervasive is because it was literally devised to get you to respond to it on social media.
Well,
this is one thing I think a lot of people don't realize.
Well, I have to say this, that if you want to hear a really interesting, and I would tell you quality, hour or so of journalism, go ahead to All Marine Radio and just do a search on clickbait on the podcast page. And what you'll find is, and I'll do it right now, so you go to the podcast page, right, and you put in, you don't have to put in Alex's name, but click on the little search thing and then just type in clickbait. And what will come up...
I'm doing it too.
Yeah, we're raising here. Is clickbait a necessity for media companies? Alex Hollings makes it smart. Listen to that. Okay? Listen to that. Because, you know, everybody rails on clickbait, right? And I facetiously joke, not facetiously, that I get every new bikini picture of Liz Hurley and Halle Berry and anybody else who's doing that kind of stuff, simply by clicking on it. Okay? Now, but here's what's interesting. You're going to get those links to major news outlets, Fox News. Why is that? Why is a company like Fox News publishing bikini pictures of Liz Hurley? There's a reason for that.
There is a reason for that. And in all honesty, it's not even a nefarious one necessarily. The reason why is because that bikini picture of Liz Hurley is helping for them to pay some asshole like me to do a deep dive into Yemen.
Right. And so it's a necessary component. And you could almost, you know how we used to discuss, like, the newsroom is over here and the editorial section's over here, and those people don't even know each other. There is such
Absolutely.
A separation. Well, you could almost say that the clickbait division is another completely different group of people that we have that find, right? Retag, repackage.
Depends on the outlet, but that, I think that that's certainly true, depending on the
outlet. Because we don't want those people corrupting our news people, right? I mean, hard news is hard news.
Independent news outlets that have smaller staffs, what you'll find is they, a lot of times, will have an editor whose job is just titling, for instance. Because the idea being, like, let's say you wrote or I wrote a really long and in-depth piece about something that the top or the public may not necessarily really be clicking on in large percentages. Like, let's say the war in Afghanistan. The war in Afghanistan and negotiations with the Taliban are very important to veterans and to the American military and to America's soul. But people don't really care. Nobody clicks on stories about Afghanistan. So if you write a story that you think is really important, a lot of outlets will have an editor whose job is to punch up the headlines, is to find a way to make that headline something that somebody will click on, almost making it clickbait, even though it is a really content-heavy, a really deep-dive story. A lot of outlets will have an editor who's just trying to trick you into clicking on it because it's tough sometimes to get the audience to care about something that's a bummer. You know, we all want to be angry. We all want to be happy, but very rarely do we want to be – do we want, like, a depressing update on how things are going with the Taliban, right? So nobody clicks on it. And if nobody clicks on it, then it becomes a less important story. It's not a less important story because the media doesn't think it's important. This is something that I really wish more people understood, is how much power you have over the media that you consume. As Mac pointed out, he keeps seeing these Liz Hurley pics in his newsfeed for a couple of reasons. One, because they sell. But two, because Facebook's going to show you stuff it thinks that you'll want to see, you know? And it doesn't, Facebook doesn't differentiate between what makes you happy and what makes you angry, because both are equally profitable, right? So one thing I really encourage people to understand is that when you see fake news, when you see a story that is really poorly representing the truth, and you comment underneath it, this is bullshit, or you share it to say, look at how ludicrous this left-wing or this right-wing take on this story is, the computers, the revenue system, doesn't see that as a hate share. It's just a share. It doesn't see it as an angry comment. It's just a comment. Everything that you do increases its reach and makes it more profitable. Your hate is what's paying their bills. So it's not just that everybody who reads Breitbart is clicking on Breitbart stories because they believe Breitbart. Half of the clicks are because they don't believe Breitbart. That's just as profitable. You know, so the way that you can try to move the media away from bad content that you think is evil is to stop engaging with it. Don't share it and show how bad it is. Don't get into an argument. Every comment increases the organic reach of a post. So when you get into an argument with some troll, you know, in the comment section below the New York Times, what you're doing is you are making sure dozens, hundreds, thousands, eventually more people will see this article because of your engagement with it. We are the ones that
it's
are
your
making
fault.
Bad media powerful.
Yeah, it's your fault. And you're getting what you crave. So if you crave,
you know,
if you crave pictures of Liz Hurley in bikini, go ahead and click that stuff, and they will happily deliver that stuff to you. But
you know, I would argue that shows to me that you've got healthy web surfing habits. You know why? Because your newsfeed isn't trying to show you stuff that's going to ruin your day. It's trying to improve your day.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very
much. I feel like you're doing it right.
But my point in all of this is that which we rail on, the whole clickbait thing, it is a real component of the revenue-generating arm of the dynamic digital media business. And it's as real as the floor mat on the floor that you walk into and wipe your feet outside the front door of those companies. It is real, 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 because that's how you have to stay. That's how you have to stay in business.
You know, you keep hearing about these media companies going through layoffs, and there's a lot of reasons why a lot of media companies go through layoffs. But one of the biggest ones is trying to find a way to manage this balance between reputation and traffic drivers. You know, you want to make sure that you're seen as a reputable outlet, but people by and large would prefer to click on Liz Hurley than on, you know, a deep dive into an important topic. So you've got to try to find a way to balance this,
right?
And a lot of companies have trouble finding it. I think in large part because we are a changing industry right now, and you've got to be willing to move at the pace of the industry.
Well, you know, here's one of the things I've noted, and this is just me, a casual observation, if you will, that I don't see those pictures. For instance, I don't see the Liz Hurley bikini pictures on Fox's website. Okay, so you're not going to see.
No, you see them in your news feed.
You see them on your news feed, and when you click on them, they come up. But it's not. So they're in the closet relative to clickbait, right? Like
no, absolutely.
You want to be seen.
They'll publish a lot of content that's not on their homepage.
Right.
A lot of times it's niche content.
But you know what? I thought? I thought, well, what the hell? Why wouldn't All Marine Radio do that? I'd be like the bikini hub of the universe, you know, relative to formerly hot models. And then I can go to people and say, yeah, I have like 9 billion clicks a day on this thing, okay? So you want to be there.
You know, I ran the first website that I ever ran was called The Mustachioed, and I ran it while I was on active duty. It started when I was in 29 Palms, and it started as a blog. You know, it was just like I've always been a movie nerd and a TV nerd and stuff. Right. So I would see a new trailer would come out and I'd post it and be like, "This looks awesome," you know. And eventually, I started talking to some female Marines I knew. I posted some pictures of them on there because I was like, "Well, that's a good way to get people to come." Within a year or two, I was having aspiring models just send me portfolios of pictures to post. And the website really did pretty well. And then I ended up shutting the website down because eventually having a bunch of strange women send you naked pictures will make your wife angry.
Yeah.
But when the advertising money started coming
through, only if she finds out.
Exactly. You know, so once the website was getting a few thousand readers a day, and I was getting stopped at the front gate on my way into base about it.
Get out.
My wife started being like, you know, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with you being the mustachioed guy. And but I can tell you that at the time, I mistaked that for good content. You know, I thought I was good at this. Because I was like, what are you talking about? Thousands of people come to my website every day. I'm obviously good at this.
Obviously.
The truth is that, like, a girl's belly button's a lot better at this than I could be.
True. You know, but now, in a much more mature way, you would use this as a surgical thing, right? As a deliberate surgical event.
Designed... Now, I will tell you, I try my best not to, but I've seen
it done. But those, if you chose to.
I've seen it done very well.
Right. If you chose to do it, this, it's a conscious decision. Based on your business model, that you've got to be there because that that drives a ton of traffic.
We know it really speaks to at the end.
Well, hold
of the day,
on, hold
not,
on, hold
not
on.
All let, that long ago. I was me, having a conversation.
Let me just finish the thought. It drives a ton of traffic, and traffic translates to revenue. And so, in this whole dynamic event that swirls on a monthly, weekly basis, right? How do I stay in business? How do I thrive? How do I stay current? And it takes money to do that. And so if I have to dance with the devil a little bit, as long as I don't get too close and French kiss the devil, I can do that, and I'll keep it a couple compartments away, but I'll still reap the benefits. That's really the art if you're a mature, you know, well-known media outlet, you know, still dabbling this because you feel like you financially have to.
And there are some ways to inoculate yourself a bit to it. Like, you'll notice that a lot of outlets have paywalls. The News Rep, for instance, has paywalls. The benefit of having a paywall is that if you know, to your average reader paying $2 to $5 a month.
Explain what a paywall is.
So a paywall is, it depends on the website. Sometimes you can read 5 articles before they start charging you. Sometimes you can't read any. What it usually is it'll let you read the beginning of an article, and then it's like, hey, if you want to be able to read this content, you need to subscribe for $2 a month, $5 a month, whatever it may be. And a lot of people on the internet get really angry at paywalls because they forget that we paid for newspapers all along before the internet came along, you know? People don't like advertising, but outlets need to pay not just the journalists. They've got to pay HR and accounting and their lawyers and, you know, whoever else. They have to pay the entire corporate structure. So you need to have these revenue models in. And when advertising isn't enough, or when advertising is making your revenue clicks, those clickbait clicks have to be a larger and larger portion of your content, The alternative is doing a paywall, which is if we know for sure you're going to pay us $2 a month and 10,000 other people are going to pay us $2 a month, then we know for sure that we can afford to keep paying these writers, these staffers, producing this content. And the content does not have to be clickbait because our bills are paid through your subscription, through your continued dedication to reading our content. Right.
Right, but you've got to have, right, you've got to be marquee, you got to have enough subscribers
exactly,
to do it.
Exactly, because then you run into the other problem of if you have a paywall, how do you entice new subscribers?
Right.
And we come right back to the clickbait model, you know? The clickbait model has shifted a little bit differently because you can't get people to subscribe based on the promise of seeing Liz Hurley in a bikini, so you have to, like, you got to shift the strategy. But the strategy is always there. The goal of the news media is not to inform you. The goal of good writers, of good journalists, is to inform you. But the goal of the industry is to pay its bills, right? So there's this trade-off. There's this constant balance. It's a tightrope act.
It's called
some outlets do it better than others.
It's called it's called capitalism. I've got a
exactly.
So first of all, I want to cover a few issues with you today. One, we had a very interesting discussion about Area 51 a few weeks ago that honestly was hilarious. The call to storm Area 51, right? And we were laughing, like, you know, so you look at, like, Google Earth and you look at the desert, right? This flat, barren place. Well, it's not really flat, barren place. So you get out of your car in your new cargo pants with your bush cover on and your Camelback and your tennis shoes, and you go about 50 yards, and you're not 50, maybe 100, maybe 200, and your tennis shoes are like ripping out of the sides and being destroyed. Now, your Camelback's halfway drunk, and you've got another 2.5 miles to go. And it was the fun.
Now, this is all assuming that you're smart enough to bring good shoes and a camel pack.
Right, exactly. Right. You know? We were laughing at the shit show that would be this thing. And so I want to get your comment. This has been called off by the organizer. Except there's people in Vegas that have said, hey, they might have called it off out at Area 51, but we didn't call it off in Vegas. It's on in Vegas. Come to our convention.
Which I think is actually a rad idea,
right.
You know, the convention in Vegas. Here's the thing. The problem with this whole raid on Area 51 thing is that the media, again, to get back to the media, like, fundamentally misunderstood what this whole thing was to begin with. It was a meme. It was a joke. This guy started a group that he never expected to blow up that was like, hey, if we all raid Area 51, there's no way they could stop all of us. The premise is a joke, you know? So then you take that premise, and then you have 2 million people on Facebook, 2 million or whatever, that just clicked. All it takes is one click. One of your friends shares it on your news feed, and it just says, yes, no, or maybe. You know, are you going to raid Area 51? Yes, no, or maybe. And all you have to do as you're rolling through Facebook is click yes. And the media went, 2 million people are saying they're going to raid Area 51. 2 million people aren't saying they're going to raid Area 51. 2 million people clicked yes on their Facebook page as they scroll down. That is a very different commitment than deciding to go to where you're talking about, in the middle of the Nevada desert, to go and see just how impenetrable to like non-lethal projectiles you really are, right? The truth of the matter is I really do think you're going to see some people show up out there on September 20th, and I think a lot of them are going to be journalists or aspiring web journalists. You're going to see as many people there to cover the raid as you will see feasibly going to conduct a raid. It is the dumbest bunch of crap I have ever heard. Like, this whole premise is stupid.
Wait.
I cannot wait for it to be over.
The dumbest? That's
okay.
Maybe not.
It drives me nuts, though, when I click on outlets like the Washington Post and the New York Times, and they're taking this raid on Area 51 story seriously.
They have to. It's part of the clickbait, right? Let me ask you this. Let me give you, okay, you can write an article about today. I'm going to give you some choices.
Well, I'll tell you, I've actually been asked and have written multiple articles on this topic. So there's truth to this. People want to read about it.
Okay, hold on. Let me give you the smorgasbord. You can write about the dance of death that the Houthi rebels are doing, bombing Saudi oil production facilities, knowing that the Iranians ultimately backed this. It's been traced to southern Iraq, which may have come out of, and that dangerous dance that goes on. You could write something about that.
Yep.
Okay. You can write something about the Modern Marine Expo that's going on beginning tomorrow in Quantico for Marines. You can write something about aliens that have landed on the roof of the White House and currently inhabit, with Donald Trump, the executive floor of the family / executive floor of the White House. Which gets the most clicks?
I will say, to a certain extent, it depends on the outlet, but definitely the alien one, obviously, right? You know? I mean, I'll tell you, when I was asked to write about the raid on Area 51 for the loadout room, I put together a gear list that I recommended everyone who actually intends to go to this raid take with them. And the gear list is pretty brief. It's, you know, just like you mentioned, a hydration carrier. I recommended that you carry at least a tourniquet for each limb, a box of adult diapers so that when you shit yourself and pee your pants because of the non-lethals that they're using, you don't ruin your pants, and a good quality satellite phone so that you can call your mom to come pick you up. And I was told that it didn't seem as though I was taking the topic that seriously, and I would argue it's because this is not a topic worth taking very seriously. But the truth of the matter is that you're going to get some idiots out there. I'm looking forward to seeing what idiots
show
up.
How did the gear list do, though? I'm sure it put up big numbers.
The gear list actually did relatively well. It really did. I think in part, though, because it got a lot of Facebook traction, social media traction from people saying, exactly, you know, this is dumb. So here's why it's dumb. You know, I like to think that, at least. But I'll tell you right now, I have certainly benefited from hate shares over my career, especially when it comes to writing op-eds and editorials. I have a habit of being wrong. I have a habit of having opinions that run contrary to, I think, what most people would consider to be what, you know, like kind of our collective agreement that something's right. Like, for instance, I never cared that we killed Cecil the Lion. I know that sounds terrible. I do care about lions in general. I don't care about this one lion that we made a celebrity. And I don't care because I recognized that, by and large, neither do Americans. Americans care about it this week and they don't next week. And I was proven right, you know. But when I ran an op-ed that week saying, who cares about Cecil the Lion? You better believe I was vilified. You know, but then a week later, nobody remembered my name, and fortunately, nobody remembered his name either, so I was able to continue my career. But when it comes to hate shares, sometimes you write an article intentionally because you know it'll make people angry. Or my favorite thing to do, I'll be honest, is I'll write a headline that I know will make people that agree with me angry, so that I can watch them share it and talk about what an asshole I am, just so that I can comment under it, you should try reading the article because I made all these points already. So the other thing we could do to make content better is actually reading the articles. If you actually read the article, you have a much better chance of sounding well-informed when you're complaining about it after.
Well, the all right. So I had to get I chuckled when I saw the guy saying, hey, look, this has kind of gotten out of control.
Well, this poor dude, just imagine. I mean, if 3,000 people get killed trying to raid Area 51, I mean, it's his fault to a certain extent at this point, right?
Right.
I don't blame him at all for trying to backpedal, you know?
Yeah, and you know, like, you know, when you have any possible means to sue somebody,
that's the modern American dream.
to sue people.
To sue your way to wealth, right?
Right.
I'm going to sue my way out of poverty.
So, So I had to ask you a serious question. 18 years after September 11th, your thoughts?
You know, this is a tough one. In part because, as I was right, I think it's safe to say that most of us that work in this sphere, and when I say this sphere, I kind of mean defense media. When September rolls around, you know, you're going to have to talk about 9/11. You know, and this was the first year though where it occurred to me that we have adult Americans living, working, and voting that have led their entire lives under this specter of the global war on terror. And it made me, when I was an undergrad, when I first started going to school, when I got out of the Marine Corps, I want to say in 2013, I remember having a teacher who graduated high school a year after me asking us all to share our September 11th memories, and nobody, it was like a really engaged class. You know, this is a mass communications class. It's all nerds like me that talk too much, and nobody raised their hands. I thought it was weird. I wasn't going to be like the veteran, the salty vet in the back of class that wanted to tell you guys my experience. So I figured this was a good one for me to skip and let them kind of speak freely without feeling like they had to censor themselves for the angry vet in the back of the room when it comes to something about war, right? But nobody raised their hand, so the teacher asked me to talk about my experience. I distinctly remember I was skipping school at the time. I was a senior, and I planned to get to school just in time for me to still be able to participate in football practice, but I saw no reason to get there any sooner. But I ended up going to school because I was scared. You know, I saw the first plane hit, thought it was a tragic accident. When the second plane hit, I knew we were going to war. I got scared, got dressed, and went to school. You know, but now, you know, I was on the cusp of adulthood, right, at that point, as an elder millennial. Now we've got people this year who will be voting, who were born after the 9/11 attacks. Mm. I mean, for years now, we've had voters who were too young to remember it. They were too young to remember a pre-war on terror world. And the reason why that's so troubling to me is because when I was a kid, I grew up very insulated from war because to me, war was something that America had just won once and for all when I was a child, right? My dad was a Vietnam veteran who did not speak about his experiences in the war, but I understood were terrible. But from what I understood, Vietnam was ultimately about containing communism. Communism was no longer a threat. You know, we won the Cold War while I was watching Power Rangers. So I didn't have to worry about that. I didn't have to worry about communism. I didn't have to worry about Vietnam. When we did go to war, when I was a child, it was the Persian Gulf War, and it was a clinic in American dominance, you know? So my family gathered around the TV and watched it like it was a movie we rented from Blockbuster, you know? There was no fear there. You know, historically, when a country goes to war, the country's populace should be afraid. You know, that's why you go to war. And none of us were. There was no fear whatsoever. I grew up, my understanding of war included no fear whatsoever as I grew up because, I was so removed from it. Today's generation of young adults grew up amid a time of ongoing war. And what's scary to me is that they are just as removed. They are just as insulated from war, despite the fact that we're in the middle of like three of them. You know, and it shows to me this cognitive dissonance that the American public as a whole has kind of exercised because we've gotten so tired from 18 years, 19 years of continuous warfare that we've just removed it from our conscious thoughts. You know, it's easy for Google employees to sign this huge protest because they're angry that Google would work with the Defense Department to try to help analyze intelligence feeds. They have no problem with helping China, you know, suppress their people because the idea of real oppression, the idea of real risk, is something that the American public just hasn't seen in the modern era, you know,
and doesn't know it. I mean, you know, to me, that is to me so stunning, and it makes me think like, am I living in like bizarro land now, where down really is up, and up is really not up anymore, because the Americans look at this totalitarian Chinese thing like, oh no, it's a wonderful place. I mean, I see them in Beijing and so you see stories about what's going on to the Muslim population in Western, you know, hidden away in Western China.
But we don't see pictures, and we don't see video.
Right.
So it doesn't stay with us.
So it's not even real, right? Exactly. And then you read the stories that come out of a totalitarian state. You're watching the video that's coming out of Hong Kong, and it's moderately disturbing. Like, wait a minute, what's going on there? I thought this was the happiest place on earth. Second
to
Disneyland.
And it's important to note that meanwhile, we are happily buying into movies celebrities that are advancing this Chinese
narrative-sponsored
narrative.
Yeah,
you know,
and that's what it is.
Jackie Chan has come out repeatedly saying that America is the source of the world's evils. Jackie Chan has come out repeatedly saying that he doesn't think the Chinese people, the Hong Kong people, any of these other people that fall under pseudo-Chinese rule should truly be free, because he thinks that when you have too much freedom, things get too complicated. These are Jackie Chan quotes. But we still think Jackie Chan's the man. We all go buy tickets when he's going to karate kick somebody in a movie. We are buying into China's narrative, and we're happily doing it, because unlike Russia, where it looks like a Bond villain, China's narrative looks like a big bag of money.
But your point is, and it's kind of interesting, I interviewed a Marine recently, and I haven't interviewed him yet. I'm going to. He's just a good young man, and he his father committed suicide on the phone with his mom and his brother when he was.
You've
nine.
Mentioned him to me before,
right.
Yeah.
So this guy, and I took him out to dinner, and we're sitting there talking, and I said, "Well, so why'd you join the Marine Corps?" And he said, "Well," he said, the Boston Marathon bombing really pissed me off." And I was sitting there thinking, the Boston Marathon, that's a significant event in Boston and all that, but...
And I was stationed right outside of Boston at the time.
September 11th? And then I thought, he was too little. That's not even a real memory for him.
Exactly.
Other than, you know, like... Well, I knew something happened. I knew my mom was upset, but other than that, I mean, I was watching Power Rangers, man. I didn't know. I was too little. So in this white noise that has been war for 18 years, like the China narrative, I think the country's been desensitized, and that all exists in the background. Yeah. We know that's going on. It's no big event. It's no big deal, and it certainly doesn't affect us. And that's where that whole thing of, I think it was General Pace that might have said that, right? The Marine Corps is at war, and America's at the mall. Well,
it's true, though.
He said that, I want to say, in 2003, 2004, right? Imagine now, 15 years later, with those events continuing, if America wasn't real concerned in 2004, it doesn't give two shits in 2019. So it's kind of interesting, you know, how that exists as white noise in the background.
You know, and I'm fortunate in that I've got a younger brother who's 7 years younger than me, which makes him a young adult. I mean, Lord knows, he's like 25, 26 now. It's killing me. But, you know, he's about to get married. And he lives out in California. And he and his fiance are pretty liberal folks. You know, I would argue that they are your classic young liberals, you know, And I don't mean that as an insult. I do think that a lot of people tend to lean further left when they're younger and lean further right when they're older. And I think that that comes through life experience and your shifting perspective. You should change your views on the world as you age, right? You know, so they're your classic Bernie Sanders supporters. They think college is too expensive, so the government should pay for it. It's not until you're older and you're paying taxes that you realize that means you're paying for it, you know, like that. It provides me with this really valuable perspective on things like the war on terror. Because if I was in high school when 9/11 happened. That meant my little brother was young in junior high. You know, he was in like fifth or sixth grade, which makes him just about young enough to remember it. But like, you know, it didn't form him. It wasn't, you know, it didn't shape the outcome of his life the way it certainly shaped the outcome of mine. Right. So when I talk to him about it, it is amazing how... us being at war is absolutely an afterthought. Tensions with China is absolutely it's not even a secondary concern. And it means that they live in a different world than we do.
Right.
And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that we need to be aware of this cognitively when we're talking about politics, when we're talking about policy, because we're not all operating with the same set of cards. We're not all looking at the same information. I got an email a couple of days ago from a master sergeant I served with that I just really respected and admired, that I had lost touch with. He came across a story I wrote and went, "Holy shit, you're a journalist now. That's awesome. I always knew you'd do something like this. You know, I wanted to touch base." And I was so excited until I checked out, you know, his social media, and I found that he lives in China. And I immediately got nervous. Now, that's not something that people who live outside our sphere experience, you know? But I, as a defense journalist, as a Marine, as a guy who has lots of friends that are in the defense community on the active side, whether in the military or, you know, in the commercial side, I, who have a lot of connections to people with clearances and stuff like that, my first instinct was, oh my God, did this guy get converted to a Chinese asset? I guarantee you he didn't. He's a fucking real American war hero, you know? But my immediate instinct when I saw that he now lives in China, has a Chinese spouse, is, oh no. You know, I need to be careful how I engage with this person. My little brother does not live in that world.
His reaction would have been, oh, how cool, so-and-so reconnected with me, and he lives in China. That's awesome.
Exactly. Now, I'm not saying my way of life is better than his, but it's important that we notice how different they are.
Well, yeah, but it's a complete world, in my opinion, it's a complete worldview. It's not.
Exactly.
It's not the myopic, ridiculous Google view of the world that, oh, so wait a minute, so you won't work with the DOD, but you'll help a totalitarian government more efficiently enslave its people by supplying them better artificial intelligence tools so that they could put Orwell into a place that even Orwell couldn't have conceived of.
You're 100% right. And it's all about what I call our comfort blinders, right? So if you're Google, if you're a Google employee, what happens to Chinese citizens is outside your comfort blinders. You know, for anybody who hasn't been around horses at all, a lot of times people who own horses will put blinders on their horses that stop them from seeing things to either side. It just helps keep them focused. It helps prevent them from getting too excited, especially when horses are being trained. You don't want them to react badly to a car driving by, for instance, and rear up. It could get somebody hurt. People put comfort blinders on because it helps get them through their day. Google employees are able to ignore what happens to the Chinese citizenry because they exist outside their comfort blinders. But when Google is being asked to help the Pentagon on a defense project, it forces Google employees to engage with the fact that America is at war, that people are dying and being killed, that there are bad guys and good guys and guys in between out there on real battlefields right now, that you're playing a role and benefiting. And then you can't keep those comfort blinders on anymore. These Google employees, in my opinion, aren't trying to stop anything from happening. A lot of them have even said, in quotes and pieces, that this is something that can go to a different, less developed firm. Google is far too developed to need these government contracts. Let it go to somebody else. So they're not saying they don't want the program done. They're saying they don't want to have to be the ones to do it.
Right.
It's cowardice. It really is. But if you take a step back and you try to appreciate that these are people just like you are, just like I am, people with wives and husbands and kids, and they've got to worry about their electric bill, and they've got to make it to that PTA meeting, and there's a lot of pressure in their lives just like ours. So what are they really trying to do? They're trying to get through their day. And the difference, I would argue, is that for people like us, because of our experiences, we can't pretend we're not at war. You know, it's not an option for us. But if you lived your whole life insulated from it, if you've been in this cocoon that tells you that war is something going on way far away and it'll never reach your door, then what you want to do is defend that position. You want to fortify your place in this safe space, and you don't want to let other people come in and violate it. The Pentagon violates people's no-war safe spaces, and that's why they don't want to do it. They want to pretend everything's hunky-dory, and people like us, unfortunately, aren't able to. And that's where I think that's where all the contrast about defense spending comes in. People talk about how America has the largest defense budget in the planet. They don't talk about how America actually spends less per our GDP than a lot of our competitors. America spends less of its money on defense than Russia spends of its money, for instance. You know, a lot of people also don't recognize the fact that America has a stabilizing presence the world over, and that's why our defense budget is so high. You can't cut the budget without cutting the requirements of that presence. Otherwise, as we saw, sailors start dying in collisions, aircraft start falling out of the sky. So these gaps in how we understand defense spending and how we understand defense policy are born out of these cultural gaps in how we're willing to see the world. People who live in my brother's realm, and there's nothing wrong with living in that realm, but people who live in that realm don't know that we're at war in a real way, and they get angry when you force them to acknowledge it. People who live in our realm get angry when other people aren't acknowledging it, because we go, how can you not understand that sailors are dying because of this? And I think we get angry at each other, but we don't realize that the real difference is just, it's just like upbringing, man. If you're raised in a house that's in rural America, you don't understand the challenges of living in urban America, and vice versa, right? But we need to appreciate that, because if we want our policy to be cohesive moving forward, we've got to be able to bridge that cognitive gap.
I don't know, man. It seems like we like the world according to GARP. And, you know, the Chinese and their ability, you know, to buy major interests in TV and film studios in the United States with the specified intent of manipulating content. And I'll tell you what, and one of the great examples here recently is Top Gun 2.
Yes.
And the patches on Tom Cruise's jacket have been changed.
Now, I don't remember the exact title of it, but if you go searching on Business Insider, you'll find an article that I wrote that was predicated on the Top Gun 2 jacket change. That for people who aren't familiar, I think it was like a tie and a Japanese patch were both removed from Tom Cruise's jacket to appease the Chinese markets, right? But that is like way far from the first time that we have dramatically changed movies to appease Chinese markets. And a lot of times, the American media even attacks studios for it for all the wrong reasons. Did you happen to see Doctor Strange or in Marvel Infinity War, you know, these MCU movies?
Negative.
The Ancient One was played by Tilda Swinton, who is a white lady. The Ancient One has historically been a Tibetan character, right? The Ancient One is the person that trains Doctor Strange in the mystic arts. They chose to cast Tilda Swinton instead of a Tibetan actor to play the Ancient One because the Chinese censors would be angry at the idea, because Tibet, again, considers itself an independent state or wants to be, and China does not consider it so. China would not permit the Chinese media, the Chinese market, to release this film if it presented Tibetans in such a positive light. So they cast a white lady and instead just got accused of whitewashing the character. And Marvel would rather get that American backlash than the Chinese backlash, because it's important to note here, Chinese censors are the Chinese government. And when Mac talks about China investing in movies and TV, he's not talking about China's version of CBS investing. He's talking about the Chinese government.
Right. And when the Chinese government says you violated our requirements, your film won't be coming here. Right?
Exactly. That costs you hundreds of millions of dollars.
There are assholes in Hollywood, from accountants to CEOs, that just slam shut.
You know, another Marvel example that I can pull from right off the top of my head is in Iron Man 2. Again, the bad guy in Iron Man 2, what was his name? He was played by Sir Ben Kingsley. But again, it was the Mandarin. Now, the Mandarin doesn't sound like a guy Sir Ben Kingsley would likely play, right? The Mandarin, again, a historically Chinese villain. But again, Marvel knew that they wouldn't be able to release this movie in China if the villain was a Chinese guy named the Mandarin. So they cast a British guy to play him. And again, got accused of whitewashing the movie in America, suffered that backlash, still made a boatload of money, and went on to make another boatload of money in China. The Red Dawn remake, they filmed the entire movie with China as the antagonist of that movie. And then, realizing that they wouldn't be able to release it in Chinese markets after they wrapped, they hired 12 different special effects teams to go change every flag to a North Korean flag. Then they hired all the actors to come back and do voiceover to re-edit the whole movie so that nobody ever mentions China. And they only call the bad guys North Korea, which made the movie even dumber. It was already a bad remake, but the idea that North Korea could invade the United States to that effect is laughable. The movie ended up failing both in America and in China, but it was all out of fear of the Chinese government. Like, Hollywood doesn't really make movies aimed at America anymore because they know they'll make their production costs back in America and they'll make their profit in China. Just ask literally every movie Dwayne Johnson has been in for the last 5 years.
There you have it. All right, man, I'm out of time for the day. I'm on a strict schedule. Tell everybody where they find your work.
Well, you can find me on social media at facebook.com/AlexHollingsWriter, on Twitter at AlexHollings52. You can find a lot of my work every day on thenewsrep.com, on loadoutroom.com, on popularmechanics.com, on wearethemighty.com. Just Google Alex Hollings. You'll find something to be mad at me about.
There you have it. The one and only Alex Hollings. Sir, hey, you have a podcast too. Is that up for publication yet? Or
not yet. I recorded the raw audio for my first episode last night. I'm really excited about it. I sent Mac, last week, if you check out Soft Rep Radio, I guest hosted an episode of Soft Rep Radio last week that was kind of a dry run, a pilot of what my podcast will be. It's kind of a narrative. I sent it to Mac to ask Mac if he could give me some pointers because, honestly, there's nobody better at this game than you, I genuinely believe. I love coming on your show. So hopefully here in the next few weeks, my show will be rolled out. It'll be called The Pop Scholar, so it won't just be about defense. I'm going to be exploring other avenues of my nerd passions on this thing.
That's hashtag in mental parentheses UFOs. Anyway. All right, Alex, thanks for the visit.
Hey, thanks so much, man. I'll talk to you later.
There you have it. The one and only Alex Hollings. Yeah, you know what, Alex? He's a smart guy, and he's intellectually I don't know, not afraid to grow. Not afraid to argue. He's a kindred spirit to my friends that are much older, so it's always fun to have him on. We're going to take a quick break, about 2 minutes long, and then we're going to come back, and you're going to listen to an interview I did with Matt Gospodinovich, originally recorded in 2016, on November 16th of 2016. I played it on the anniversary of the building being dropped by one of the biggest explosions ever, conventional explosions ever to rock the planet on October 23rd, when we remember the Marines who fought and Marines and sailors that died in the Beirut bombing. And so Gospo was one of those guys. And so, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. I've got a few thoughts before, it goes. So don't touch that dial. More Ball Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.